down to 14 seconds.
Oh, almost stolen by Drexler. Boy, is he good at
that. They've got a drive to the basket. It's down to 7 seconds.
You can see the time. Wittenberg. Oh, it's a long ways.
Oh!
You know, one of the things I've seen Duke do in the past in situations like this is try for the quick pass to half court and call a quick timeout so they can get in better shooting range.
There's the pass to Leitner. Puts it up. Yes!
Going to go length of the court with Archie Diacono. 3 seconds at midcourt.
Jenkins
gives it to Jenkins for the championship. Champions with Jenkins hitting the winner at the buzzer. Again with ball in his hands in the paint. Floater short, got it back, ties it with three. Gonzaga has time to do something. Sox for the win.
This is Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
Oh, some brunch with the big fella, and what a night last night. 800-919-3776. 800-919-ESPN. Over the next 3 hours, join us. So much to talk about on Twitter. At Chris Carlin, by all means, check in there. Instagram, that guy Carlin. That was a night for the ages, a game for the ages. I frankly was sad at the end. I was pulling hard for Mick Cronin and UCLA. Mick Cronin has been a guy that for the longest time has been regarded as one of the better college basketball coaches who couldn't necessarily get over the hump, get to a Final Four, and he does that this year. People felt like maybe he wasn't a great fit for what the UCLA culture and history is, and he's been terrific. And in every way, this was a college basketball game where he designed the absolute perfect game plan and never deviated from it throughout the night. And then on the other side, you have Mark Few, who has been at Gonzaga for 22 years and has turned them into a national powerhouse, but a team that, while it has played for the championship, has never won the championship. It's hard to believe it was just a couple of years ago in 2017 that they made their first Final Four. When you look back at what kind of a program they have been over the last 25 years. It started with Dan Munson taking them to the Elite Eight. And people were so locked in on calling them Gonzaga. They still are. Still can't get the name right. So you had these two teams last night. One that many felt like didn't belong there, and one that was chasing history. And from start to finish, it was one of the greatest college basketball games we have ever seen. It was right there with NC State winning in 1983 on the Lorenzo Charles dunk off the Derek Wittenberg shot that we heard. It was right there from their regional final between Duke and Kentucky in 1992. It was right there with Duke and UNLV in 1991. UNLV chasing history, trying to become the first undefeated champion since 1976. And in the national semifinal, Duke knocks off seemingly the team that you could never beat, a team that had just blown the doors off them a year earlier for the national championship. Villanova and North Carolina a few years ago. The moment that every kid dreams of in his driveway growing up playing basketball, putting up the shot to win the national championship. And Chris Jenkins got that opportunity, and he did it. And then you have a game like last night. And you think about the fact that you had 19 lead changes in the game. This was a heavyweight fight. And in a lot of ways, this was Rocky I. It really was. You had the team in UCLA playing the role of Rocky that nobody ever expected to really have a chance in a fight like that. Yet somehow they just kept answering back to this dominant team every time, seemingly, that Gonzaga, the heavy favorite, a 14.5 point favorite, they closed as the heaviest favorite in a tournament Final Four game since the tournament expanded in 1975. And they are answering every single punch that Gonzaga throws. Every single one. This was a Gonzaga team that had not been tested all season long. 29 of their 30 wins were by double digits. And you have an unbelievable individual effort in one of the great sequences you will ever see in college basketball lore, with the block by Jalen Suggs, and then chases the ball down and then throws an unbelievable threading the needle bounce pass of about 30 feet up the floor to finish on the other end. As incredible a sequence as you can ever see in a basketball game, yet UCLA would just not go away. Players on both sides rising to the moment. You know, this was an NCAA tournament that frankly wasn't really a barn burner up until last night. I mean, game one was disappointing as could be. Houston getting their doors blown off by Baylor, and that wasn't close from the get-go. And last night was supposed to be the game that was going to be the blowout in those two. Nobody expected UCLA to hang. Cronin, with a game plan of slowing it down, never even wanting his team to run the break, even when the opportunities were there. It was so perfect. They hit tough shot after tough shot. Man, that was Hagler and Hearns the first round. That was Rocky and Apollo Creed in Rocky One. It was in every way a brilliant, brilliant sporting event. Sometimes we just have to sit back and enjoy what something is. Just sit back and enjoy it. It's a game that I want to go back today and watch in its entirety again. And Jalen Suggs at the end, after Johnny Juzang follows up his own shot. And as you heard Kevin Kugler on NCAA's radio network on Westwood One describe at one point, slithering in. Such a brilliant description to get the follow. And then on the other end, Suggs. And his teammates talking about, we run it all the time in practice, and he does it all the time in practice. Never want to take games like that for granted. Who knows what we're going to get tomorrow night? Hopefully we will get a heavyweight fight and a game that is worthy. But I don't know that you can ever pass what that was in the championship game tomorrow night. I still can't get over 19 lead changes. 19. We can't ever take games like that for granted. I can't say that enough. And I'm somebody that, frankly, does from time to time. You know, I'll sit there and watch a game, and sometimes I kind of, you know, I'm checking my phone, I'm doing other things, I'm trying to watch, but I'm not as locked in as I necessarily should be. Well, I'll tell you what, over the last 6-7 minutes of that game and into overtime, couldn't rip me away from that game. That's why we're supposed to love the sport so much. And just in the bigger context, just step back and appreciate the fact that those two teams gave you that game last night and what they have been through all season long, what UCLA has been through with their problems. But just getting through and not fully understanding the sacrifice that these student athletes made all year long to get to this point. Like, unlike any other before, not seeing family for months at a time, not seeing friends, not having a life outside of basketball and virtual classrooms. I mean, you see Johnny Juzang before the game yesterday. There was a great moment where his brother from Vietnam flew in. He hadn't seen him in 8 or 9 months, surprised him. And he's doing an interview with CBS, and he looks over, and there's his brother on the other side of two doors, and he can't even go over and give the guy a hug because of everything that's involved, but he's just so happy to see him again. When I tell you the sacrifice that, these kids made all year long to make sure that the tournament even happened, and while it wasn't that great to begin with, this was just a moment in a game that made it all worthwhile, and nobody deserved to lose it. Nobody deserved to lose it. I am heartsick for Mick Cronin and UCLA today. Heartsick. I feel good for Gonzaga. They get a chance to finish off history with an exclamation mark tomorrow night, but that's one that we can never take for granted. What was your favorite part of all of that last night? 800-919-3776. 800-919-ESPN. We're just getting started. Brunch with the big fella, around with you all afternoon long. We will talk some Yankees in a few minutes before they get going against the Blue Jays at 1 o'clock. We have got plenty on the Mets and an interesting situation that we learned about last night. In terms of the future, who will be here and who may not be here that we're taking for granted a little bit. We will also get into whether or not one player is actually worth keeping around for the Mets, and the Jets and the draft and the continuing saga over the next month as to what they will and won't do and the keys in which they are driving this entire draft.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
Hit me up. You can hit me up on Twitter as well, at Chris Carlin. By all means, do that. And on Instagram, that guy Carlin. Let's hit it off with Spike in Jersey. Spike, what's up, baby? How are you?
First of all, happy Easter to everybody in your family. And as a function of being my age, I've probably seen as much basketball as anyone could see at, my age. That's one game short of being the greatest ending in any championship in any sport ever. Just one game short. You know what I'm saying? If that, that's the finals, man.
It was just off the charts. And I don't put it in the same vein as some of those other finals games, okay? I put it probably third all time behind...
Behind Leitner?
No. I would actually put it in front of Leitner, believe it or not. And I would actually say that I would put it just behind Villanova and Carolina a few years ago, and just behind 83 NC State and Houston. And the only reason is
George.
It's a final four game.
Yeah, but if it's the finals, I'm saying it's right there.
Yeah, no, listen, if it's the finals, I think it's probably the greatest.
That's what I said. I just said that. Yeah, that's what I thought. I couldn't get – I'm just like you. I'm on my phone. I got the nickname on another TV, a blowout. I'm looking all over. And the last 7 or 8 minutes, my eyes were in a straight path with the cathode ray beams, whatever comes out of your TVs now. I felt really bad for Mick Cronin. And I listened prior to the game on Westwood One. I was all over the place. They had an interview that Jim Gray did with Jabbar and Walton. Now, you love Walton or you don't love Walton? I happen to love him. I loved him when he played, before your time, I'm guessing. And I went to high school when Jabbar did. And those two guys gave a pep talk. And after the interview, I said, they got a shot.
Yeah.
They got a shot. What a great game, Chris. What a great game.
Amazing, Spike. It was absolutely amazing. Listen, I love Walton. I do. And part of it's personal, part of it's just, I know he's, you know, a goofball, but the guy just loves the game so much. And to hear him talk about UCLA the way he does, with the reverence with which he does, I understand where he's coming from on that. And I've always loved Walton. Always.
Yeah, me too.
Because
injuries kept him from being one of the greatest ever.
Oh, no question. No question. And thanks for the call, Spike. Injuries kept Walton from being one of the greatest players ever. I mean, what he went through with his feet in the NBA was staggering. But I will say, from the greatest games of all time, it's right there. It is absolutely right there. But it's why... And I don't mean to sound too hokey about it, but, you know, on this Easter Sunday, it's why we love sports so much. It's why you get as into it as you do when you have moments like that. It was absolutely amazing to enjoy a game like that. Absolutely amazing in every way. 800-919-3776. 800-919-ESPN. Want to get into some Yankees before 1 o'clock, when they will try to take the rubber game in the series with the Blue Jays to open up the season. Yesterday, a couple of things that we want to get into. Number one, I have been just getting destroyed by the pro Gary Sanchez crowd after 2 days. Look, I get it. It's a terrific start to the season, and I give the guy... all the credit in the world. And frankly, I think it's very a heartening sign after the bad spring that he had. He had the great start to the spring, and then he was in a funk for the last 3.5 weeks or so, where he couldn't get a hit to save his life. He was terrible. And you come into the season and you think, oh God, that's the Gary we're going to get. When you're trying to move into the year, and he has started the year with 2 home runs. He has hit the ball hard in those both instances, and the swing has not been as long. It's all very encouraging. The thing I would just say is, can we not overreact to a 2-game start to the season? Can we not just assume that Sanchez is in a spot now where he's absolutely going to have an MVP type year? Because that's the reaction I'm getting from a lot of the Yankee homers out there. You know, you guys just have to freaking relax, okay? Take it when you can get it. Take it for what it is. Understand that it's a good start to the season. And if you're going to see it as more than that, you're just asking to get let down in a major way. That's what you're asking for. Because he's been a major letdown throughout his career. So why wouldn't you expect that? It's been great to see him start the first couple of games like this. But let's not get too nuts about what's happening. You're just asking to get kicked in the groin. That's basically it. Number two, I've seen a lot of this morning. People getting bent out of shape over today's lineup because Giancarlo Stanton is not in today's lineup. It's the third game of the year, and you're just saying, well, whoa, you can't play, you can't play. Guys, I have no problem with how Aaron Boone wants to handle Stanton and Judge here through the first few weeks of the year. Whatever they feel like they have to do right now with all these guys, even Hicks, you'll see Hicks with a day off here shortly. These guys who are so susceptible to muscular injuries when it's still chilly early in the year, you can knock them for not being amazing players if you want, who play every day, considering what they are. I mean, they are amazing players when they're on the field. I think we've absolutely established that. But we need to keep them on the field. So if you're going to get bent out of shape right now about him not being in the lineup today with Stanton and about Judge DHing today, guys, just relax. I mean, if this means it's going to pay a dividend for you in a few weeks and later in the year, you need to rest them as they can. Would you sign for 140 games from each guy? If you wouldn't, you're out of your mind. Of course you would. Of course you would. And you're going to get the kind of production in 140 games from those two that you would get from anybody else in 155. So you take it and run. If you have to play those two like you're playing a catcher every week, I'm doing it. They got nothing to lose. Number three, I really am wondering what Corey Kluber we're getting this season. I really am very curious as to which guy it is. Brian Cashman made the point that they don't expect him to be vintage Corey Kluber. And I don't know how you could at 34 years old, having barely pitched in the last two seasons. Yesterday, you watch him, and there are moments where he looks absolutely brilliant. And then there are other moments where he's just uneven. He's doesn't have any command at all, and he's walking guys. So it's early in the year. You give him the benefit of the doubt as long as he can continue to run out there. And you hope that he gets into a groove by the time we hit May and he's consistently giving you six innings. That's definitely possible for Kluber, okay? He's your number two starter. It has to not be possible. It has to be probable. We'll give it time to ease into it. But you also get him back and hope that he is at that juncture of his career where he completely understands what he has, how he uses it, and how he's going to be most effective in getting people out. Corey Kluber's brain is going to outdo anything he has physically right now when he's on the mound. So I think with that, you get a little bit heartened by a start like yesterday because you see flashes, but you still understand that that's now three in a row where it's uneven. And I'm going to chalk it up to just getting back into some kind of groove here, considering how little he has pitched the last 2 years. And then lastly today, Domingo Germán. It's a guy who won 18 games a couple years ago. Can we not overstate his importance this year? I don't know that we can. Is that right? Not overstate or overstate? You know, I have a degree in English from Hobart College, and you would think that this is the kind of thing, considering I speak for a living, that I'd be able to get out correctly. But no, absolutely not. The overriding issue is my larger mental deficiency. And then it's just that I'm not that bright. Can we overstate the importance of Domingo Germán this season? We cannot. So I'm anxious to see him in start number one this afternoon to see where he is after not pitching last year. And again, you're going to give him a chance to ease back in. It's early in the year. It's still chilly. All those mitigating circumstances. But I do look at the Yankees right now, and you are waiting on a lot of guys to kind of round into form early in the year. They have this luxury that other teams don't have, this ability to have a large margin for error early in the season. The number one thing I want to see at least consistent early in the year is their ability to hit in the clutch and have that not be a storyline moving forward. And I'm a little bit worried that that's not going to be the case. Jay Bruce helped that out with a seeing eye dunker yesterday. But otherwise, first couple of games, you haven't exactly seen it. And that's what you're keeping an eye on. Again, two games, not getting too wrapped up in it. But there are aspects here that could become storylines throughout the course of the season that you want to have it go away right now. So it's not, right? Runners in scoring position hitting better. And Gary Sanchez just being more consistent, period. He doesn't have to be an MVP. Just be more consistent. So that you don't have to have these as stories that linger over the team all year long. And the importance there is it establishes that this is not just the same team they have run out there the last few years. So many Yankee fans I've talked to about this have had that same mindset. Is this just the same team that we've run out there? And as a result, why would I believe that we're going to be able to get over the hump this year as opposed to other years? It's a fair question. You'd like to get those storylines out of the way early, so that's not what you're focusing on. So the guys are not answering questions about it every day.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
Let's make this interesting. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Carlin on 98.7 ESPN, 800-919-3776. Got open lines. Let's hit him here shortly. Want to get back to the Jets for a few minutes and something I only get to talk about Friday night relatively briefly. And it came out of something that Steve Young said earlier this week. I believe he said it on Thursday on KNBR in San Francisco regarding Zach Wilson and the 49ers and the Jets.
If they can figure out how to get Zach, that's their number one first choice. I just don't know how they get it done. The Jets have committed to Zach and recruited the family. I mean, I don't know how that gets undone, but, you know, look, a lot can happen. I think Zach would love it. The family would love it. Nothing would make anyone happier. I think the 49ers, that's their unstated first choice. So that would be wonderful. If it can happen, they'll figure it out. And I agree with you. I think he's ready to play. Now, there's going to be some growing pains and everything else, but he's ready to play. He's a settled kid. He's not going to be overwhelmed. And the way that the 49ers, the team that is going to be handed him, I believe he's kind of a generational talent. And that's more than just how he throws the football. It's just his demeanor and his capabilities. Even though he's younger, I really believe in the kid.
I'll tell you, there are just so many things I love about hearing all of that. And the number one thing you can take out of it as a Jet fan is the Jets are running this NFL draft. They are running it. You have the Jacksonville Jaguars clearly taking Trevor Lawrence. I mean, even the coach admitted as much, Urban Meyer admitted as much earlier this week. And then there's the Jets, who everybody is so convinced is taking Zach Wilson. And they very well may be. Yes, it is the prevailing thought. How many times have we been in this position before, with a month before the draft, where there's a prevailing thought and it turns out to not be the case? So let's examine this from a few ways. Number one, we've talked about the Jets potentially taking Zach Wilson and then moving on from Sam Darnold. And if you honestly believe that this is the guy and it's the best guy that you're going to get in the next couple of years as a franchise quarterback, and you think he is a generational talent, then you don't think twice about it and you draft him if that's how you feel. If you have any feelings that Wilson is very close in ability in your evaluations to Justin Fields, even Trey Lance for that matter, and even Mac Jones for that matter, why would you not investigate a deal with the 49ers and have that lead up here in the next couple of weeks? Build it up a little bit more. Let it be known, maybe just somewhere. You slide out that we could talk about something. You know, there was, when the 49ers made the trade up to the number three spot, everybody just assumed that they must have tried to trade up to number two and they couldn't get there because the Jets wanted Zach Wilson. And everybody assumed the same thing with the Eagles. That's why they traded back, because they couldn't get to Zach Wilson. Well, a couple of things I've heard. Number one, the Eagles are in such disarray right now that when you look at this inability to get people in the building because of COVID, and you can only spend 5 hours on a Zoom call total, one each with your organization, with a prospect. So think about that. 5 hours on a Zoom call as opposed to actually spending some time with the player and trying to get a feel for who they are. That's what you get in evaluating them on a personal level, in addition to whatever kind of information you can get outside there. It's not like you can go and set up a secret workout anywhere. Guys are not working out just for you as they have in years past. So if that's the case, and you feel like Wilson may be very close to another one of these quarterbacks, and you want to draft a quarterback, why not slide back one spot and do, frankly, what the 49ers did a couple of years ago? You know, San Francisco moved up to number three. So they had to be comfortable with Justin Fields, or they had to be comfortable with Mac Jones, or Lance for that matter, to say, if we don't get Wilson, it's not the worst thing in the world. But if you move up that far and you give up what you gave up, and the Jets were to ask you for, say, a second round pick for this year, or maybe even a little bit more, is that going to keep you from moving up one spot? It shouldn't. It shouldn't, if you truly believe in him. If the Jets feel like Justin Fields or one of the other guys is pretty close, why not get more? If you do feel like one of those other guys is going to be better than Darnold this year, or overall. And I still don't back off of what I still believe to be the best play. And it's just my personal, I don't want to say lack of belief, because it's not a lack of belief. My personal hang-up with drafting a quarterback at a time when you're at the number two pick and you're trying to set your future up, and you realize how much you need to build your organization, to build your team, and you can cash in and get a ton in return for it, and you're not willing to do it, I mean, he better be right. He better be right. And that's a pretty big matzo ball out there. Because when you're a general manager and you're picking a franchise quarterback, unless your name's Howie Roseman, you usually get one bite at the apple. You're not going to get another chance. Because if it doesn't pan out, you're screwed. You're screwed. And your organization is set back 5 years. Look what's happened with Sam. Sam hasn't had anybody else around him because Mike Maccagnan was so awful in drafts and so awful in free agency that he killed them. But Sam not developing either or making anybody else better around him and being healthier out there hasn't helped the situation either. So I just have a real problem in picking a quarterback who was, frankly, a one-year wonder this year, has been somebody that dealt with injuries before. Okay, that's fine. And was not on anybody's radar at this time last year. At this time last year, if Zach Wilson had been in the draft, he wouldn't have been drafted. He might have gotten a look as a free agent. Why would I do that when I have less information than ever before? Why would I take that risk? Man, I think that's asking a lot. If they didn't want to move back as far as 12, that's fine. But there are so many options here for the Jets. They are in the driver's seat, and that's what you have to feel good about. So should the Jets just lock in on Wilson and take him? Or should they maybe slide back one spot and get another second-round pick this year? Or maybe try to slide back to 8 and get even more picks? And let Sam play this year with more around him. You're not picking up his option. And if it's not there, you look for your guy next year. When you are armed with assets to get him, if you're not in a draft position to get him, what would you do right now? Because we're going to be talking about this for the next few weeks. And guys, as much as everybody's just, I'm not saying they're wrong. The Jets may be locked in, and I'm not going to complain one bit if they draft Zach Wilson, because to me, that means they have that strong enough belief. But I think it's riskier than ever to do it.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
In case you missed it, last night, Andy Martino from SNY had a tidbit that he tweeted and wrote about that the Mets, during this spring training, engaged Jacob deGrom on the idea of a contract extension. Now, you'll remember DeGrom signed his extension a couple of years ago before 2019, and it was $137 million for 5 years. And this year, Jacob DeGrom is due to make $36 million. Well, so why would the Mets want to engage him now when seemingly they've got all the time in the world? Well, DeGrom has an opt-out after the 2022 season. So 2 years from now. But the bigger issue is that DeGrom, in agreeing to that contract, certainly agreed to a deal that I think we can see is under market value. While he might be making $36 million this year, 13 and a half of that is deferred for 15 years. This is a Wilpon special contract. $52 million of the $137 was deferred. And when we say deferred, each year there was a set amount off the salary that will be set to be paid later. It won't be the same value in today's dollars, obviously. And by later, we mean 15 years later. So it was, we're going to give you a contract that probably is a good deal for us, and you'll be happy to get big money, but you're not going to see more than a third of it for quite some time. Jacob deGrom, this past offseason, fired his agents. And when you look around at the contracts that got rolled out, when you look at deGrom and you look at Trevor Bauer, I'm sorry, it's not close. So you talk about the other guys who have gotten paid. And this is just another sign that things are different with the New York Mets. and a very positive sign. Now, they're not talking about an extension right now. It's been put off for a while. They're not going to do it during the year. But the fact that they would approach him, understanding he has an under-market deal, understanding that he has spoken with a fondness of staying with one organization for his entire career, it's a very positive development. And again, another just piece of evidence that it is a different time with this team. You feel so good about that, right? So good. So you expect that to pick up after this year, and hopefully it will get done where he is never going to leave the New York Mets. Guy has just gotten better and better and better over the years. Well, the one thing that has come up with that is Michael Conforto. So when Lindor signed his contract and got $341 million, there was one immediate fallout from that. Conforto's price went up. I know fans love Michael Conforto. I'm going to give you a list of guys right now that have contracts that are over $200 million, which is where now Conforto is reportedly looking. And who's his agent? You know who. Scott Boras. These guys, these position players, all make over $200 million over their course of their contract. Mike Trout, Mookie Betts, Lindor, Fernando Tatis Jr., Bryce Harper, Giancarlo Stanton, Manny Machado, Nolan Arenado, Miguel Cabrera, Anthony Rendon, Robinson Cano, we all know all too well, Albert Pujols, and Joey Votto. What's the point here? Michael Conforto is not a $200 million player, folks. He's not. And there's a strong feeling to me that he's not going to be a Met beyond this year. And I'm okay with that. If it means that Jacob deGrom is going to be a Met and is not going to opt out after 2022, I'm fine with that. If it means to me that I'm going to develop some other outfielders or I'm going to go and try to get somebody else, I'm fine with that. Michael Conforto, during his career, I don't feel like has been a consistent enough player to justify $200 million. Now, am I saying that he's not a better player than Robinson Cano or, you know, what Giancarlo Stanton has given the Yankees and the Marlins out of his contract? No, this is not what I'm saying. When I look at the players who were truly worthy of that money, Conforto's not on that same level. He's not. Some of those contracts are massive albatrosses, as we know. And it was a mistake of the moment and the timing. I feel like with Conforto, this would be a mistake of the moment. We've had health issues in his career. We've had a couple of seasons where, just frankly, he hasn't done enough. You look at what he has been for the entirety of his Met career. He's not worth $200 million. Not even remotely. And I wouldn't give him that. I get that he likes it here, but, you know, for his career, if you guys want to talk about advanced stats and all that, you know, he's been in the big leagues since 2015 and played 50 games that year. So we're talking about, over his career, 630 games, and his WAR is 14.7 for his career. It's not great. I look at the years where he's had big years. I look at 2019, 33 homers, 92 RBIs, OPS of only 856. When you have those kind of numbers, shouldn't the OPS be higher? Played 150 games that year. The year before, played 153 games, hit 243 and an OPS under 800. Like, what am I missing here? He's had a couple of good seasons. His career in the clutch, not that great, especially the high leverage situations. $200 million for Michael Conforto is not an option. So I would start to prepare yourselves for Conforto not being a Met for the long term. Because just frankly, look at the entire picture, and he is not worth it. High leverage situations for his career. 239, OPS of 800. Two outs, runners in scoring position. OPS, 785. Late and close. OPS, 684. These numbers, they're not good. They're not good. So, from the Met fan perspective, when we start talking about next offseason, I know how much you like him, unless he puts together a massive year. And I mean massive. Where he does drive in over 100 runs. Where he plays 150 games. Where his OPS is well north of 900. It's like 950. He hits 35 home runs. There's nothing to talk about with Conforto being a $200 million player. So I'm perfectly content right now. If that's where they were talking about, if they were talking about 150 or so prior to this deal they got done with Lindor, with Conforto, $200 million. See you later, Mike. No problem with letting him walk.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
Last night, every time you get a chance to hear Bill Raftery, to me, it's a treat. And he, at one moment, brought up my friend who passed away, the guy I did Rutgers basketball with for a year, Jerry Recco, did it for the last 5 years because there were some cutouts of Joe Boylan that were in the stands behind, I think it was Johnny Juzang's father. And they were showing Johnny Juzang, and there were two or three of them. And Joe was the former athletic director at Loyola, and Loyola had those put in there. I thought it was phenomenal. And just an amazing guy. And Joe knew everybody, including Raf. And Raf mentioned Joe and mentioned what a great guy he was. And Raf is along those lines in that he is just the most amazing individual in terms of always smiling, always laughing, always having fun, and just loves the game so much. And just on that personal note, I really enjoyed the fact that he said it. And the first time I ever met Raf was in 2003 in New Orleans. I was with Chris Russo. I was with Dog at the Final Four. And it was a bar in New Orleans. And it was about three deep from the bar back. In other words, that many people, three deep all along the bar, waiting for beers. And we were meeting up with a couple other people. And Raf sees Dog, and he sees me. And Raf is 6'5", 6'6". And just over the crowd gave me a, "What are you drinking, big fella?" It is one of the all-time highlights of my life to hear Raf say that. And then later, at the Big East tournament one year, he goes, "I always knew you were a loudmouth." He's just the best. 800-919-3776. I'm so thoroughly annoyed with the Knicks situation right now. And the reason being is that we talked all leading up to the trade deadline about the thought process behind what they were doing. And it didn't necessarily have to be about trading for a big player for a long-term commitment. It didn't have to be about trying to pry away Bradley Beal from the Wizards, even though he wanted to stay there. It didn't have to be about that. It didn't have to be about securing a long-term commitment from Victor Oladipo in order to get some help, in order to make a deal like that. You could have brought in Victor Oladipo for the rest of the season. You could have brought in Evan Fournier for the rest of the season to help out. So, you look what those guys went for. Evan Fournier went for 2 second-round picks. Victor Oladipo went for a pick swap and Kelly Olynyk, basically. And these guys, while Oladipo wanted to be in Miami, they are still free agents at the end of the season. And I've heard this a lot the last week since the Knicks didn't make a trade from some of the Knicks fans who were kind of apologetic and understand that they're trying to do something long-term. That the guys here, they deserve to be rewarded by not making that big, big trade that would break everything up, and they deserve a chance to go out and do this on their own. Like this, by not making a deal, this was the reward. And that to me is just utter crap. Utter crap. You didn't have to do something that was going to alter the future of the franchise. Trading 2 second-round picks for somebody like Evan Fournier, that would not have been the worst thing in the world. That would not have set the Knicks back in their plan at all. And that would have been the true reward to help out a team that needs help offensively. And what has happened since the deadline? We have seen how much help the Knicks need offensively. You can't continue to expect Julius Randle to do all of this. You can't continue to expect RJ Barrett to play at this level and be that great second option. Why not bring in somebody else to help take the load off a little bit? That is rewarding a group that has bought into everything that Tom Thibodeau has been selling this year. And now, I know what happened last night, okay? I'll get to that in a sec. Now you're starting to see where maybe they're running out of gas a little bit. You have asked so much of them, and the depth factor is not what you would want it to be, that you could see them slowly and steadily run out of gas the rest of this season. And frankly, that bothers me. They needed help. So then last night, after the Knicks have dropped 3 in a row, people are pointing to the fact, oh, look, well, I guess they're not that tired. They came and blew out the Pistons. Folks, the Pistons have not been interested in playing virtually all season. Can we be clear? They're 21 games under 500. They are 14-35 this year. Just stop. The Pistons are not interested at all. You know what the Pistons are? In my younger days, when you would go out, I was always a guy that would tend to start to hit a wall around midnight, even though it was going to be a longer night and you knew it. And you had to somehow summon the energy. Right? The Detroit Pistons are a can of Red Bull at midnight to get you to 4 a.m. They will perk you up temporarily, but you can't rely on them to be there every night to really carry you home. And of course, here we are. Who's next? The Nets. Who's after that? Boston. I mean, the stretch is starting to come up here, guys, where this is going to be a real problem. And I am worried that even though they are at 500 right now, and even though the Eastern Conference is what it is, I am worried that maybe this could start to fall apart a little bit on them. Are they not going to make the playoffs? No, they're going to make the playoffs. And I mean, the 7 through 10 series, because they're not going to fall below 10. that's not going to happen. But I have hopes that the Knicks could actually be a top four or five team. And it's getting harder and harder to see where that's going to happen. When you consider that they really needed to help this team. G in Long Island is up next, 98.7 ESPN. G, what up, baby?
What's up? What's up, Colin? How you doing, man?
Good.
How you feeling? Happy Easter, by the way.
You too. Hope you and your family enjoy the holiday.
Thanks a lot, man. I'm a little bummed out about all this DMX, you know, stuff going on. You know, he's in the hospital, so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that there had been a report last night that he was coming off life support, but then he's back on it. I don't know what the very latest is.
Reports about it, but we just hope he pulls through.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Carlin. When we drafted Obi Toppin, you were very, like, big on it.
And I was very happy about it, yeah.
And how do you feel about that now?
I think it's still very early. I don't think he's done well at all. I've been very disappointed in him not being a bigger factor offensively so far.
Yeah, Carla, we need a point guard. I know you talk about Oladipo. You talk about all these deals. Knicks haven't had a point guard in so many years that we need a point guard. That's what we need to talk about. We need a point guard. I don't care what the situation might be. I just wish we can somehow, like Halliburton would have been perfect for us right now.
He's second. Oh, there's no doubt. Halliburton's playing phenomenal. I'm not going to give up on Obi Toppin right now, but Halliburton, the one thing you could say about Toppin that would concern you is it's not like he didn't come in like Kevin Knox at 19, at 18, you know, he's 23,
yeah, exactly.
You know, so you need him to develop quicker than you would a guy like that. And
yeah, everybody said he was the most NBA ready. You know, I listened to you a lot, Carlin, and you even brought it out that he's the most NBA ready prospect. It doesn't seem like that. I don't know if it's
coaching. He doesn't look it. I'm not going to deny that I was very high on it, but I think that right now you're seeing a guy that is very much trying to figure it all out. And I know what we saw the other night was a little bit encouraging, but even I didn't take much out of it when he's attacking the basket and all that, because I almost feel like sometimes when he actually gets a chance, he's always just going in to try to get the highlight dunk. Like that's not what it's about right now. It's about him getting better and fitting in better and understanding defensively what his responsibilities are, because we know when you're with Tom Thibodeau, you better know how to do that. You better look sharp defensively and understand what you're doing and what your assignments are. And when Toppin is getting the minutes that he's getting right now, that to me is the biggest reason why. And even offensively, he doesn't really know what he's doing. That's been disappointing. There's no getting around that. I'm not giving up on him. And I hope that he can be a more explosive offensive player and be a big factor here next year, but he is, you know, 23. He is not 20. So that would bother me.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.